This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Today I'm going to start with my guest. Kate Mildenhall is an acclaimed Australian novelist whose work blends rich characterisation, evocative landscapes and sharp social insight. Her novels Skylarking, The Mother Fault and The Hummingbird Effect have established her as a writer who moves confidently across genres while retaining a deep interest in human relationships, community and the pressures that shape them. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisa.
You're so welcome. So let's talk about your book, The Hiding Place. And on the surface, The Hiding Place begins with a group of relatively well-off city-dwelling families pooling their resources to buy a country property. They imagine an idyllic landscape, or an idyllic escape, I should say, of nature and community and a place to begin again. Although very quickly their ideals unravel as morals are compromised and truths rise to the surface. Is there a particular place, real or imagined, that influenced the world of this story?
Yes, there absolutely is. And it begins really with the local real estate agent in my little town on the outskirts of Melbourne in Hurstbridge. Mm-hmm. And the spot where I used to pick up my kids from school, where I saw a sign in the window that said, "Town for sale. Be mayor of your own town." And I've been part of a massive camping crew for many years since I was a kid. Last year at height, we cooked for about 50 people over our summer camping. And we have always tossed around the idea that maybe it would be easier just to all pitch in and get a property together that we could camp on. So when I saw this advertisement, I immediately put it in the WhatsApp chat, just like Lou does in the book, and said, "Team, I found a property. Let's buy this property," which of course sounded like a great idea, but very quickly I realised that it potentially wasn't such a great idea. Someone else did buy the property though, beautiful property out on Gurnai land near Walhalla.
Okay, all right. So very interesting that it came from personal experience. In an interview you once quoted Charlotte Wood, and you said, or she said, "The book will tell you how it wants to be written." So The Hiding Place has six point of view characters, has short, punchy chapters, illicit substances, a gun, an affair, a death, and a very frightening deer.
Yes.
How did the novel reveal itself to you?
Oh, that's such a great question, Lisa. That's a writer's question. So one of the criteria that I put in place for myself, I put two criteria in place for myself for this book, before I really got into the weeds of it. One of them was that it was only going to be set over 3 days. So I wanted a very short time frame. And that was partly because my latest novel, The Hummingbird Effect, was set over 250 years. Took me 4 years and kind of did my head in. So I was like, short time frame, and I want a dead body. I want to try crime. And, you know, I've laughed about this about partly because I want to be in on the crime gang because they are among the best people in Lit World. They really are.
Really?
Yeah. They stay late after festivals. They're really open and honest with giving advice about their own writing process. So they share a lot. And they're always up for a beer, which,
I'm
really
happy
about.
Do they drink wine?
Sometimes, yes. All things.
Okay.
But so they were the two criteria I put in place for myself. And I wanted to have fun this time around. I could feel this, you know, this is the fourth novel. And I could feel I was getting maybe a little bit earnest, maybe a little bit pushing towards saying, "This is my idea, reader, and I really want you to pick up what I'm putting down," instead of kind of being more open with that and entertaining. So I wanted to have fun, which I really did. And so in the way that it revealed itself to me, I guess, is it had to whittle itself down from, I had 17 points of view at one point with all the adults, which is, you know, untenable, really.
Yeah.
You can't put a reader through that.
Mm.
And I also experimented with killing lots of different people. In lots of different ways. So at various times, there were more dead bodies. They happened in different ways. There were bodies disposed of in different ways. But over time, and with some great feedback from some other crime writers, I whittled it down to what you see on the page now.
That's so interesting. So did you go and ask some crime writers like what their tricks are? And
I asked so many crime writers what their tricks are, particularly in green rooms and at festival drinks.
Did you get some really answers that surprised you?
Yeah, great ones. So one of them was Chris Hammer talked about the idea that in his novels he always has kind of four mysteries to be solved.
Oh,
so he's got
okay.
like one or two big ones,
mm-hmm.
And then like number three and four as well. And the idea in that is that a reader, even if they guess kind of like three of those mysteries, one of them will still be a surprise to them. So that's the way that he does it. And then you've got people, and I knew this from the podcast as well, you know, Jane Harper writes the last scene first. Someone like Leanne Moriarty, she doesn't know who did it or why until 60% of the way through the writing.
Mm.
Hayley Scrivener, who's someone who gave me some great feedback on the novel, one of the things I asked her was like, Hayley, how do I ethically know who to kill in the book? And she was
good
like
question.
Nah mate, we don't worry about that, you just kill whoever kill whoever you want. So these were some of the kinds of bits of feedback that I really relied on in getting through it.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've done your research extremely well, I have to say. So let's talk about some of the themes. The novel explores class, land use, and social and political dynamics between seemingly stable communities. It contrasts parenting and generational differences, especially through the character Stella, whose teenage perspective exposes cracks in adult behaviour, which I really found funny, actually. Were you interested in examining how different generations navigate morality, responsibility, and privilege?
Yeah, all those things. That's such a great way of putting it, Lisa. And what I was, you know, Stella is the only kind of teenage or child character who gets a voice, and she was a joy to write, difficult to write. I had to rely on my teenage daughter at times to check that I was getting things right. But one of the things that she functions as is kind of as the moral compass in the book, because what she's doing is at all times seeing straight through the grown-ups' hypocrisy. So, you know, when they get to this property for the long weekend, it's the first time they've got there. Lou, the organizer, is trying to get them, you know, with their butcher's paper and their Sharpies and their post-it notes to collaboratively work out the rules and the principles that will guide their staying at the property. And of course, they come up with all of these rules, and then the adults can proceed to break every single one of those rules while holding the children to account for what they don't, you know, when they step out of line. So Stella's role was to really hold those kind of ideas up to the adults, which I think is what teenagers and young people do so very
well.
They
do. They really cut through the serious stuff, don't they? I found that particularly funny when they were like, the parents were really opposed to glow sticks.
Yeah.
And yet, murder's okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And all these little bits. And I think that they were the...
Well, not murder, but...
Yeah. But they're the tensions. Yeah. You know, they're the tensions that I think that sometimes that idea of, you know, bringing in the idea of the parent who's the anti-vaxxer, or the parent who disciplines differently, or the, you know, the different ways they're using medications with their kids and the way they're talking about it, or the kinds of ideas that come up around food and who eats what and what you're allowed to do with food. All of these... are the things that I think they're tiny, right? They're so small in comparison to the idea of hiding a body potentially.
Mm.
But they are the kind of linchpins on which so many relationships can break down. And I thought that was really interesting to play with, because all of these characters, the adults at least, think that they are good people, that they are really good people, and that life should treat them well.
Mm. I think when you have this quote, this is a quote of yours. Write what makes you buzz, and from there you can start to think about how to get it out in the world. And I feel like this is the crux that has really made you buzz. This sort of dichotomy, this sort of sense of what is good and how that is broken down, essentially. I also thought what made you buzz, I could be completely wrong, was this tonal shift from satire into chaos.
Yeah. Yes. and playing with it, I think one of the things, and, you know, you mentioned Charlotte before, and one of the great exercises that she did with me at one point was to, I had to write down kind of what I wanted a book to be like, and it could involve art or other novels or shows or things like that. And so, you know, for this novel, I really did want, I had a list of things like White Lotus, the book The Slap, the show Deadlock, which is a terrific Australian TV show done by Kate McLennan and Kate McCartney. Very, very funny. So I had this idea of kind of, and then a whole lot of crime thriller shows that I'd been watching as well and books. And so I wanted to stick my toe in the water of being able to do a dead body and let's work with a dead body, but also to have fun with it. Which makes me sound like a terrible person, but also to take the mickey out of myself. Mm. And this idea of these people who are kind of inner city progressives, left-leaning, very much like me and my friends. And I've heard people talk about this rule before. I know Mark Mapozza-Russell, the writer, has talked about it. You know, that one of the ways you can do satire really well is to make sure that you are the subject of it at first glance. And that really helped me kind of get into it in a way that I felt comfortable doing it too.
Yeah. Okay. I love this book. It was so much fun. And I guess we're running out of time. I've got like 400 more questions, but I will just go with this last one here. So let's go back to the first question I asked you about Charlotte Wood's quote and the book teaching you something. So I guess, what has this novel taught you about writing this time?
I think what it reminded me, Lisa, is it took me back to writing my very first novel and the kind of freedom and delight and enjoyment I had with that. Mm. And that was my goal for this time round, to get back to the core of just enjoying the writing and wanting to entertain readers. And I really feel like I got that for myself. But I can see from, you know, reader responses so far that people are also enjoying that part of the process too. So hopefully into, you know, the new novel, which I'm starting to work on, that I just loosening up into that freedom of, as you say, of letting the book tell you what it wants to be. So crossing genres, if that's what happens, and making sure that I'm enjoying the process.
That's brilliant advice, I think, for all writers. So thank you, Kate Mildenhall, for being my guest today. Your book is The Hiding Place and the publisher is Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Well, we're going from crime and death to horticulture, herbology, chemistry and psychology. Now, if they sound like upper levels of secondary school, then these are the readers that will enjoy this book. Amy Dyack has mixed all these elements with a thriller in What Have They Done to Liza McLean? Welcome back, Amy.
Hello. Thanks, Jan.
Douglas College is the oldest and most prestigious school that has an intensive horticultural program and a school logo of the sun and intricate leaves, but it also has misbehaving students who need to report to the principal. Liza McLean is one. What has Liza done?
So, yes, Liza is a bit of a troublemaker. She's new to the school, a scholarship student, actually, and her sister Meg, who is not a troublemaker at all and very conscientious, is quite annoyed at Liza most of the time.
It's sister Meg who's waiting for her outside the principal's office and hears Liza's light and melodic laugh and hopes that Liza has charmed the principal. As you said, there's quite a difference between the two.
So how on earth did I end up with a little sister like Liza? Me all sharp insides and soft round exterior, and her lean and angular outside with the lax and easy disposition. Her tall and dark, me short and fair. It's almost as though we're opposite in every way. Not almost, we are. They so very are. Different.
Oh, yes. So Meg is really scared of something because Liza's such a fun-loving, outgoing person, but...
Yes, so because they're quite late to the school in their academic life, and also they're on scholarship, so Meg's really worried they're going to get kicked out of the school.
They're charity cases.
Yeah.
In contrast, there is a very entitled Benedict Hargreaves the Fourth. He's outside the principal's office too. What behaviour has brought him here?
So Benny, as he's known to those close to him, is very unimpressed by everything the school stands for and hasn't got much respect at all for it, to be honest. And he's found that there's a few dodgy things going on. So he's been doing some background research of his own.
Involving computer hacking.
Yes.
And what he's found is locked folders on some of the students and records of past students, their work stuff, their life stuff, things that the school should not be keeping such thorough records of.
Correct.
Or let's be honest, keeping records of it all. That comes from the book. So he's been found hacking. What's his punishment?
He has to go and help out with, there's a beautiful greenhouse on the grounds of Douglas College, and every year there is an open gardens day with some of the very posh houses around the town where the college is set. And the school provides a lot of the plants for these gardens, so they look pristine and people come from all over the world to visit these beautiful gardens. And so Benny has to go and help out his worst nightmare, digging in the dirt.
Oh, dirty. But it's an unusual school that, this is a quote, "We have the names and types of so many plants drilled into us from such a young age. It's a weird skill to subconsciously acquire." But what is Benny warned by Dave about when he goes into the greenhouse? It's an experiment, a grade four experiment, a plant, a smelly plant. We know the school's interested in horticulture, but some students are interested in other areas of the curriculum. And you've given us Serge Mazipa and Kevin Kim.
Yes, they're our little local community computer nerds.
Computer nerds.
Absolutely love everything to do with IT.
And then there's Max Fontaine, quite different.
Yes, Max is pretty flamboyant and loves design and art. And one of the things that the students have to do is all wear white to the Open Gardens Day. And Max makes a little bit of cash on the side for creating some amazing outfits for the students.
Meg, because it's a boarding school, Meg's roommate is Clara, who's also a scholarship person and very studious and polite, while sister Liza's roommate is Anne, who has no personality. But then Liza's got a bestie, Kitty DeVries, who comes from a very wealthy family and is fun-loving like Liza, but gets people into trouble.
Yeah, she's pretty awful, actually, Kitty. She's a bit snobby and definitely has her favourites as to why some people are accepted and others aren't.
Well, there's a town, a little heritage town just outside the gates of the school. It's picture postcard. Tourists flock on weekends. Young townies are mainly from farm workers or backpackers, all quite keen to party with the wealthy younger teens from boarding school. Why is that?
Well, I found the idea quite interesting of young people in a country town that are quite isolated versus the students that sort of are shipped in to study there and what that dynamic would look like and perhaps the judgment that might come from both sides of the group.
But all the boarders have got com bands.
Yes.
Well, quote, like a skinny rubber smartwatch which alerts to school announcements. But perhaps it's also got a tracking device.
Yes.
So, of course, the com band comes off when some of the boarders sneak out to the townie parties. And what happens when Eliza McLean sneaks out with her friend Kitty? She comes back completely changed. The title, What Have They Done to Eliza McLean?
Yes.
How's she changed?
Well, she's gone from this fun-loving, no responsibility type of person to being very studious all of a sudden, very serious, only caring about her grades, spending a lot of time in the library, which she'd never set foot in prior to that. And Meg knows immediately that something is a bit off.
Absolutely. Meg's roommate, Clara, she's been at the school for a number of years and she's seen this happen before.
Yeah, she's sort of always assumed that perhaps this is something that happens when students are starting to not perform and they have to step up. But they start to realise that it's not so much about grades and more about almost a personality transplant, it feels like. Some
brainwashing, she says. Well, Meg is really worried. She needs to help. She needs help to get into the school database to see if student grades drastically changed. Who can help her?
Unfortunately, it's only Benny.
Oh. So the story is told through alternative points of view. Meg tells about her feeling. I quote, sweaty palms when I'm angry, stupid grins and giggles when I'm dying of embarrassment. I'm perpetually inappropriate. And then there's Benny. Benny noticed Meg on her first day there just earlier in the year. And he also realised that she wasn't intimidated by him. So let's hear a little bit about Benny.
So Benny says, it's like I don't know who I am around her. It's confusing and frustrating. I can feel my face scrunching up, mimicking my thoughts. I sit down on the couch and tap my laptop into action. I don't know why I'm such a dick sometimes. Actually, yes, I do. After a lifetime of being told I'm nothing more than my father's name, my default mode whenever I feel insecure is defensive. I become a bully like him. It's pathetic. I'm pathetic.
Well, he's not really. That's
no,
his judgment.
We love him.
The book starts with the line, I'm going to have to kill her. But this isn't the murder victim. There's a death in the greenhouse, and this brings them together. Meg and Benny, their insecurities show that a possible romance blossoms. But why is this death kept a secret in the school?
Well, it was not Meg and Benny's intention for the death to be a secret, so this creates more of a mystery for them as to why the staff members are so keen to not talk about it and cover it up.
Well, the big weekend, the open garden celebrations, and that's where the climax happens naturally, and the warning to respect nature, knowing how powerful nature can be. Well, we started talking with Kate about death. Now, I was quite surprised about death in a YA book, yeah. But you say it's what the readers want to read.
Right. It's really interesting doing school visits and talking to students, and they all love, I think there's part of them that loves the crime and the mystery and the puzzle element, but there's certainly also something that is appealing about trying to understand something that's so removed from your real life that students really enjoy. And so true crime as well as crime fiction is something that is really popular at the moment, really fun for them to read, and I'm here for it. I love it.
So we've got do you mix with the crime gang too?
The crime, Kate is so right. The crime gang is amazing. Sometimes I feel writing YA that I'm on the kids' table and don't get to be with the grown-ups as much as I would like. And so I do, the crime gang have treat me like one of the big kids, which is great. And they're so generous and so fun. And I think maybe if you're writing about dark things, the opposite to that is how you are in your outside world. And that's what I found with the crime people are fantastic.
Well, Amy Doak has also written the whole Eleanor Jones series. Is Eleanor still going on?
Yeah, Eleanor number 4 will be out next July, actually. Oh, so wow. I'm just editing that at the moment. Exciting. Yeah.
What have they done to Liza McLean? Sister Meg needs to get into the school database, which requires help from the very handsome and wealthy Benedict Hargraves IV. Horticulture, herbology, chemistry and psychology are all in play, as well as murder, in this YA book by Amy Doak. Look, we're very lucky to have in this community of authors that come together, who know each other, who are comfortable with each other and give each other big hugs when they see each other.
They're always very excited to see Kate.
Yeah, same with you, Amy. Absolutely. Any chance for a hug?
I think there's more hugging going on in the room than there is in the books.
As long as there's not murder going on in the room.
That's right. We don't want any murder
in
the room.
Keep the murder to the books.
Thank you. So did you have any problems with the bodies and everything, or you could just find that you could?
I try to keep a lot of the really gruesome stuff off the page and sort of stay in that cosy mystery territory where if you're not so interested in the gore and you're just interested in the puzzle, that's okay. There is a few little moments that might keep people on their toes. I'm very conscious that I would like all ages to enjoy. One of the things that has been so great with the Eleanor Jones series has been the broad age range of readers. Like, I have readers sort of from 12 through to in their 80s who have told me how much they enjoy it, and I would love for that to be the case with everything I write.
Yeah. Mm, I think we're very fortunate to have deaths.
Death on our doorstep. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for being our guests today. And
you've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.